the edge of our hope, at the end of our time. We've chosen not only to believe in ourselves, but in each other. Today we face the monsters that are at our door. Today we are canceling the apocalypse.
Now get the hell out of our galaxy.
The strength of this starship lay in its diversity.
You see, our glorious diversity, that is not a threat to who we are. It makes us who we are.
You don't just let things happen. You make a stand. You say no. You have the guts to do what's right when everyone else just runs away.
But we must fight this darkness that is threatening to engulf us. Each of us must be a ray of hope.
Rebellions are built on hope.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanti Show.
When you mess with the gods, they're gonna mess back with you.
I'm Jen.
I'm Trishy M.
And today we have Betsy Dornbush on with us. Welcome, Betsy.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited too. We've been trying for a while, so, you know, finally got our stuff together.
Right.
So Betsy is the author of several novellas, short stories, and the main reason that we are here today, which is the, I think, final book of the Seven Eyes trilogy, Enemy. So I figured we'd start with a quick recap of what the series has been about and how it has culminated in Enemy.
Exile is the first book, and it starts with Draken being accused of killing his wife, falsely accused. And the country that he lives in, the law is that they don't actually execute anyone. They sort of leave it to the gods. So he gets exiled instead to an enemy country. He does know a little bit about it. He studied it some, but he isn't, you know, he doesn't know as much as he thinks he does. And in the process of trying to figure out who killed his wife, he gets dragged into what he thinks is a civil war, but turns out to be a war with the gods.
And then the second book, Emissary?
Emissary is, it could have been two books. It's pretty sprawling. He has to go back to the country that he was from under pain of death. So he tries to kind of disguise himself. And the war with the gods has spread to that country too, unbeknownst to him. So he gets deeper into it there.
And then, so Enemy gets us right back into that war of the gods, correct?
Right, right. And Enemy is really the book where he learns that all the things that he thinks has not been true. Everything sort of gets upended.
So does he realize, because unfortunately I didn't get to read the first two books, does he know that it's a war with the gods in the first two books, or is he just now learning that in the final?
No, he does. He understands, and he's pretty bitter against them anyway, so, he accepts that, but I guess he isn't. It takes him a while to figure out that the influence that they wield, because so much is done through people. And so it takes him a while to put it all together, you know, that this is actually influencing, that they're actually influencing what other people are doing. So it kind of feels like maybe more like a civil war among people, but he has insight, you know, so he knows more about, I guess, because he has people telling him that are connected to the gods. He has people helping him. So he knows more than the regular people do about where the motivation is coming from.
Right. Obviously, Book of the Seven Eyes, the Seven Eyes are the gods. How did you go about developing the approach that you took to religion in the entire series in general, but more specifically in this, with a sort of final showdown between the different religious factions? Because not everybody believes in the Seven Eyes. You have, you know, other groups that are involved in the fight as well.
Yeah, they all, it's interesting because there are seven moons, which are widely attributed to being the actual gods. And so they appear each night. And so in that world, pretty much everyone believes in them. everyone pretty much has the same basic Sekhet, you know, the same religion. But there are different interpretations as happens in real life. So that's really kind of where I went with it. As the series developed, I started looking at, well, how would different cultures approach the same religion, which obviously happens, you know, happens all the time.
Right. Clearly, we've got even our biggest religions are, in some senses, different interpretations of the same religion.
Right.
Okay, I didn't realize that's what was going on, so that's really interesting. Because you have as the Moonlings and the Monaeans, and they're each taking, it seemed, a more monotheistic take on a pantheon?
I think because they don't really, but they sort of have their favorites.
Gotcha.
They sort of have their favorite gods. And when the... You know, as enemy unfolds and he starts to realize that the gods are actually fighting against each other, that's not really a spoiler. He starts to really put that together fairly quickly. And by the way, each side really would like to have him on their side. So that's a lot of how he gets dragged into it. That's how I guess it could come across like they don't actually believe the same thing. But it really is basically an interpretation because because people are choosing sides.
Gotcha. Okay, that's interesting. So now I'm going to go back to my original question that I was going to lead off with, which is, since this is the third book, and you have a lot going on in this, you've got quite a few different characters. Obviously, you've got seven gods that you have to contend with.
Yep.
Various different countries and nation states within those countries.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of different factions. How do you keep track of the threads over the course of three books?
Right. I hope I did. Well, one, my editor, Jeremy Lassen, is awesome. And so he's helped a lot. And he did all three books. So I have that backup, which is significant. But I've been writing the books for 10 years. So they're really... You know, they're really in my head. I mean, when I started a new project this year, I was like, wow, this is really weird to write something completely different because I've been writing these people for a long, long time. And I'm not a fast writer. And I had written Enemy Exile probably 10 years ago and tried to sell it and didn't. And then it got picked up. And I was meant for it to be a standalone. And then I had toyed with the idea of maybe making it a trilogy but not seriously. And then they wanted more. So the publisher wanted more. So it became a trilogy because we do what, when people say, here's some money, we do what they say.
That makes complete sense.
Yeah.
Since these have, you know, Exile was published in, what, 2013, so it's now 4 years later.
Mm-hmm.
How do you remind your readers of the various threads? Like, what tactics do you use to reintroduce the characters to, A, a new audience, like myself coming in, but B, to those people that have been reading this entire time, but since... There's always a spread between two books. I can't think of a single author that produces one every month or so. So how do you remind us?
Probably the biggest thing is the character, Draken. He's kind of brooding. I don't know if you've noticed that about him. and so he tends to think things through and, you know, think back on regrets and stuff. So that was a useful tool. Again, Jeremy was instrumental in going, here, you know, we need a reminder here. So put a little, you know, throw your reader a bone on what the situation is. It can be tricky because you don't want to do too much and bog it down with, you know, with backstory. And yet, yeah, you have to have that in there. You've got to have readers. And I think a lot of the readers of Enemy have been new to the series. So hopefully they want to go back and finish the series. you know, read it from the beginning. But I've heard that I've got some readers that are interested in it that didn't read the other books. So I'm told it works. But, you know, I'm sure there could be some amount of confusion too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I came into this, knowing a little bit about Draken from, you know, just reading interviews with you and whatnot. And obviously the brief synopsis and everything, but not knowing, you know, the different divides between anybody or, you know, the characters or the relationships to each other. And you get up to speed fairly quickly. I didn't feel lost, if that helps.
I would agree with that. This was also my first book reading in this series. And, you know, I could tell there were a lot of moving parts at the beginning, a lot of different people and different factions. But I certainly may have missed some implications here and there, but I didn't have any trouble following the main plot with all the little reminder cues or background cues that you scattered around there.
Right. Some of it too is, you know, may have played a part in an earlier story. You know, some of it may be, I mean, there's sort of a general conflict between the five races in Akrasia and, you know, and mistrust. And so it's part of the fabric of the world, but it doesn't necessarily always impact the conflict of what's happening right that second, you know? It's more like a general, this is the way this world is shaped. So I think in that case, it didn't necessarily, there weren't details necessarily that impacted understanding the story.
And correct me if I'm wrong, because it seemed like you actually went more into something that I don't think you had, or the story indicated that you hadn't really gone into in the previous books, which is the Septons.
They were new, yeah, to the story.
I love them, so please write more. maybe it's my, you know, feminist self, but having a matriarchal society sitting there on the fringes of what is otherwise a patriarchy was really interesting. And you played with my expectations of how that would work out with certain characters.
I kind of liked them because they were a little bit no bullshit. You know, they were like, the whole world is just screwed up and we have a thing that works for us. So we're just going to go over here and do this and live this way. And I think, you know, and I just kind of like that, I guess, you know, because I live near the mountains and I know a lot of people like that sort of go to the mountains and leave some of, you know, some of our sort of the world now behind. Some of that lifestyle behind. I guess maybe that inspired it a little bit, but they surprised me too. So I wanted to explore more of Akrasia. When I wrote Enemy, you know, when we were in the editing process of Enemy of Exile, this is the problem with having three books. It's like having three kids named with the same start, the same letter. You run through all of them every time. When I was doing editing on Exile, they were like, hey, oh, we need a map. And I was like, oh, yeah, sure, I'll get that right to you. So I had to draw a map, which appears in all the books, which is a wonderful, wonderful map. But I pretty much drew it that day. So I just, that was when those people were created, was that day, basically. And so I kind of had them in the back of my mind, like, oh, I'd like to go find out what they're really about. So that's why I sort of have him go across the country and on a chase and Enemy, just so I could indulge my own exploration of Akrasia, of this map that I had drawn a long, long time ago.
That's awesome. Because, I mean, if you hadn't written about them before, it's like, oh, well, I have all this material. What am I going to do with it?
Well, and I think you kind of, you know, I guess because, you know, it's my first trilogy. And I think you kind of, in a way, owe it to your readers to give them something new, to look forward to. And Akrasia's not a huge country, but it's big enough to support several kinds of people. So You know, it wouldn't be doing, I guess, the story justice if I didn't go figure out what they're about, you know, what they're all about.
Right. And clearly you have a pretty diverse cast of characters in the first place. So giving a little bit more of the backgrounds of the rest of the world just seems to make sense. So one of the big things that, and maybe this is a conversation that occurs throughout the series, is the fact that the people find out about Draken's past, about his bloodlines in a more fleshed out fashion. Specifically, they find out that he's a former slave.
Yeah.
So maybe you can tell us a little bit more about your approach to slavery within this world, and then more specifically, sort of the prejudice that goes on, not just with the slaves, but like, as you said, you've got five different ethnicities going on in Akrasia. So the sort of the prejudice that goes on amongst them, and more in detail about the prejudice towards slaves.
Right. He, and it, even bigger than him being a slave is that he's mixed race.
Oh, right.
And it actually goes, back in exile, he gets that hatred of the mixing races explained to him that, that it was, you know, mischief done, to get people to mix, and that it's not proper and right, and that, you know, because everyone is so racist that they really think that they're sort of the most important race. Each race thinks that, and so you wouldn't want to taint your blood with anybody else's. You know, yeah, and he's a slave, so he ends up in a country, and by enemy, he's a prince. He ends up in a country where there is slavery, and I can't imagine that anyone that has been a slave would ever think that that's a right thing to do. So it's a pretty much a no-brainer that he doesn't believe in it. However, you know, I think I like to play a little bit in the gray area with him of, you know, him being advised, you can't just free all the slaves. You can't just do this. This will really screw up the economy. This is like our entire culture is built on this. And so you can't just do this thing, which he really would like to do, which is basically make everyone free. And so he doesn't. And that really bites him in the ass later. So he gets his for not going with his original thought. But that's really the most important thing. And also that he is from Monea is a big deal too. Because that's considered an enemy country, and they're, you know, and now he's their prince. And so they, you know, a lot of people would feel like, okay, they sent this person over and, you know, he looks like us. But he now is, you know, he's become a prince, but so it's like, Mooney is infiltrating us from the, you know, at the top. A lot of people would feel that way. I don't know that I really go into that, but that's sort of the general feeling around his race and around his background.
Well, that definitely is one of the things that bites him in the ass in Enemy, is that people take advantage of that history and the general feelings of hatred towards them. And it seems to be the impact of what occurs in Emissary, which, even though I didn't read, you get pretty quickly that things did not go so well in his diplomatic mission in the previous book.
Right. Yeah. He pretty much has to run. He pretty much escapes by the skin of his teeth. I like writing fight scenes, and I totally indulge myself in Emissary on writing fight scenes. So he had to pretty much cut his way out of the city, out of the city that he was in, and escape. And then he still was chased down, and he still had, you know, still there was a battle at sea and all kinds of stuff. So,
and then with this one, it does not, the pace does not let up.
Yeah, I get bored, so, you know, I have to keep them busy.
That makes sense to me. I'm cool with that. But you really don't, you mentioned that Draken's a brooding character. he's not given a lot of opportunity to actually brood in this.
Yeah, right.
You have his very brief moment at the beginning where he's, yes, in mourning, but okay, things are good. And then that's like, what, 10 pages? And and then the rest of the book is just him getting screwed from one point to the next. I think
he's like used to it by then. I think he's just like, oh, whatever, this is my life, you know. He's so negative, he sort of just decides, I think he decides he's going to keep going until someone makes him stop. And he just happens to be good enough at what he does that no one is quite able to make him stop. But he assumes he could die at any minute and he will fail. He has this assumption of failure, I think, that just pervades his personality. But he still just keeps going because there's nothing else to do, you know?
I was interesting, yes, just at in your acknowledgements at the end, you said something like that Draken is for all the people struggling with depression, just keep going, something like that. So do you have any kind of personal connection or, you know, people you know who've been doing that, struggling with depression that you want to talk about?
I do. I have a lot of friends. I don't. I do not have, I never say never, but I've never had that struggle myself. So it's something in a little bit of a way to try and understand. I think for me, it was writing Draken was a little bit of a way to understand. And I don't know that I necessarily got it right all the time. I don't think you can, except I don't, my experience with many friends and family who suffer, it never really quite manifests the same way anyway. So I think everyone has their own journey with it. So that's kind of what I thought, well, this is his journey with it. He responds in anger a lot. I've had that with my kids where, you know, really they're got some depression, but you know, it's easy to get angry also, about that. And so, yeah, I just know a lot of people that do suffer. So I guess it's a little bit of my love letter to them that, you know, if he could do it, you can do it. And everyone's important and everyone's essential. And we need everyone. We need everyone, whether you're suffering from depression or not. We need you anyway, you know.
Yeah, what you said about just for a moment about lashing out in anger, that makes me think of this book. When I just started out, it seemed rather basic in, you know, here's a prince, here's a siege, here's an angry guy, this is going to be a pretty simple book. But in fact, there are quite a lot of layers to some of the characters. So I was interested in how you made it subtle without seeming so on the surface.
Oh, wow, that's a big question. I think I get bored, and so I have a really hard time writing simple things, and I find myself adding stuff that sometimes later I even have to go back and take out because it's like, well, here's an avenue we do not need to go down. This is a whole other book, you know? So, you know, I guess I write the characters the way that I see them, and everybody is really gray, and everyone has moments of being likable, and everybody has moments of not being so likable. And they, you know, I guess some of the motivations I think are universal and pretty simple for Draken. You know, family is a big one. Trying to belong is pretty simple. You know, trying to live up to the responsibility he's been given, but also, everybody has their own personality and their own way that, you know, everybody in real life has our own way of dealing with our basic responsibilities that all on the surface look alike. So that's sort of how I approach stories.
So one of the things that struck me as really fascinating was, and it seemed to be one of the ways that Draken is able to cope with his depression, with his anger, is Bruce, which I don't think I've really seen before. I mean, it basically it's sort of a symbiotic entity. And since I'm not familiar with the first couple of books, when does that happen? Has Bruce always been there for Draken? And how do you manage to develop a character that exists within another character?
Well, it helps that he's a totally a Greek chorus and he has a good sense of humor. So, it gets wearing to write somebody who's kind of down and depressed. And so Draken needed somebody who could give him some shit that Draken could do nothing about. And so I think that's kind of how he came about. But really, story-wise, he appears in the first book. I want to say it's been a while, obviously, since I've read it. I want to say maybe a third of the way through. There's a problem. So in each book, Draken is given some magic. And in the first book, it's a magic sword. But my only rule for writing Exile years and years ago was that I could do whatever trope I wanted, but I had to subvert it somehow. And so the magic sword is not very pretty. Its magic is kind of different. It actually can be used to bring people back to life, but it's done through killing another person. So there's a little bit of, necromancy runs through the story. And so it's a little bit of a twist on necromancy. And, also he has no idea how to fight with a sword. So I thought this would just be a good way to subvert. Well, that becomes a problem. If he's given the most, famous magical sword that's really a political item and makes a huge political statement, the people with him realize that there has to be, he has to be able to fight with a sword. People are going to expect that. It would be really weird if he doesn't. And so, so his friend Osias, who's a necromancer, finds a spirit willing, who was a good swordsman, finds a spirit willing to sort of come back to the world, but be contained within Draken. And they have a love-hate relationship. There are times when he really, really wishes Bruce would just shut up. But he never does.
Yeah, I had moments where I was like, I'm just not going to even think about the sex life aspect of having two people in one body. I'm just not going to go there right now.
I'm not going to go there. And it's kind of funny because I did play with that, I think, more in the first book. By the time the third book, some time has gone on and he's very used to Bruce. And, well, he actually loses him for a while and gets him back, but he's used to the idea of having him and actually really has a lot of respect for him. By now, Bruce has saved his life several times, but I do play with that in the first book that there are some sexual differences that Draken has to try really hard because he sort of gains all of Bruce's memories. So he has to learn how to filter some of the stuff out that isn't that he's not comfortable with. Because Draken's pretty straight. he's pretty boring.
I wouldn't say that. So you just mentioned, and now it's perfect time to explore this a little bit more. So he gets new powers, new magic powers in each thing. First book is the sword. Second book, I'm going to assume, is the healing.
Yep.
And this one is the dark sight.
Right.
And this really was one of my favorite aspects of the book, is that, as you say, each one of the powers has a definite drawback to them. So the sword, not only does it take another life, it can also hurt him, which definitely comes into play.
Right.
The healing, yes, it heals him, except for the sword damage, but it also can take down an entire city.
Right.
Doesn't happen in this book, but happens in the previous one. And then now the dark sight, which is actually a pretty big impediment to him more often than not, it seems.
Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about just deciding to make them as much disabilities as they are abilities?
Yeah, I think it's a pretty firm and fast rule that abilities should have a disability, at least in my writing. I guess because I tend to see everything as gray and everything with two sides. I have a really hard time not seeing two sides to everything, but it doesn't make sense to me that you would have an ability, but it wouldn't sometimes be frustrating. You know, like fame here, say maybe you're a wonderful singer and you become really famous and rich and life is wonderful, except you can't go to Starbucks without, you know, getting your picture taken because you're so famous that no one will leave you alone. So that was kind of where that idea came from. I wanted to play with, disability. He has a lot of ability, and I really felt like he needed to be knocked down a peg, I guess, because, you know, he hasn't been knocked down enough, but I felt physically, he needed some kind of disability. And the other thing it does in Enemy is it makes him rely on people that he would probably try and turn his back on. He would walk away from his sister and Tyrolean, his best friend, and he even sends his daughter away. So because he feels that this all centers on him and he's so dangerous to be around that it isn't right for him to have these people around him and put them in danger. And besides the fact that they just won't go, he gets in a situation where he has to have help. He can't get around really during the day very well at all without help, which is why he has the blindfold on on the cover.
In a lot of ways, he can barely get around.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a bad knee. He's got a bad shoulder. Yeah. I loved the moment when you have him thrown to the ground and he says something about hitting his bad shoulder again. And then he was like, I don't know if Bruce says it or if it was his own thought, but it was like, of course it's my bad shoulder. I seem to fall on it all the time.
Right. Well, if you've ever had an injury, and I've had several in the snowboarder, you do. It's like the world is magically attracted to that injured.
Right, like it becomes magnetized or something.
It does. And so I guess that's kind of where that comes from. That he does. He sort of gets hurt a lot. And you know, he's older. He's 40. He's been in a lot of battles. So you know, the idea that he doesn't have some aches and pains would be ludicrous. One of the favorite things I did is when he gets an enemy, when he gets his healing ability, it doesn't heal all his past wounds. So he still has the bad knee. And he's just like, really? Like, this is some cruel joke that you give me this ability, but you couldn't take my sore shoulder away, you know? The shoulder actually happens he gets a dislocated shoulder in Exile, and he does not get along with Tyrolean, but Tyrolean, being a soldier also, is really the only person who knows how to fix the shoulder for him. And they sort of bond over that injury and then become friends. So that's where the bad shoulder comes from.
I had a feeling, because this was another one of the clues that you kind of put in. Random soldier gets their shoulder dislocated, I think in the first few chapters. And he's like, been there, done that, you know, basically.
Yeah. right.
That seems to happen every time we see someone get hurt. Ah, yes. Yeah. I'm well familiar with this situation.
Yeah. Dude, I'm so sorry. I know exactly how that feels.
Yeah, but I did love that he actually has to deal with the repercussions of his life. Don't actually see that in heroes, oddly, very often. Not sure why.
He makes some bad decisions, and he has to own up to them. And he has his own prejudices. You know, he, on the one hand, he generally accepts people for who they are, but he also was raised, you know, with prejudice, so he can't just set that aside all the time. And so it's, and also he tends to get in trouble when he doesn't sort of trust himself, which I think is a little bit of just a theme sometimes that I play with, that, you know, if you don't, like, we all know what to do at the right, you know, really do when it gets down to it, whether we want to do it or not. And so, I mean, how many times do you look back and think, God, I thought that I should have done this, you know, but I didn't, and now I'm dealing with it. So that happens to him a lot. I mean, that's kind of his growth, I think, is learning that he needs to trust himself and accept, and really accept his responsibilities.
Yeah, and one of the people that, God, I can't say it without spoiling it, but he definitely is reminded by a certain person that he fucked up, basically, that he didn't accept his responsibility while accepting it. You know, like, he's got a war going on in this book in himself between Nation and his daughter.
Right.
And he justifies his decision by saying, oh, it's for my daughter, but he's still, in a sense, kind of copping out to the direct responsibility to her, because he thinks he's protecting her, but maybe he isn't, you know, and he definitely pays for that in a pretty big way. And it seemed to be that this was one of those places where his depression really affects his decision-making process, because he gives up.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a definite point where he feels everything is lost, and so there's really nothing left to do. And so his sort of, he always just goes, you know, and starts killing things when things don't go his way. And so I think he sort of just decides that that's all he's really good for. And so that's what he does for a while. I didn't get into it super deep, but I think, you know, some time had passed. Before he really then has to come back and realize all is not lost, and he could still fix it. And, you know, the biggest war for him is his insecurity versus, which I think depression really contributes to, but it's his insecurity versus his, you know, versus his ability, because he does have some ability. He has some good abilities that, he has some natural abilities, and people try and tell him he does, and he doesn't believe them.
Right. And so he is definitely confronted with that at a certain point in the book. Like I said, I'm not going to spoil it. This is a pretty big spoiler.
That would be a big one, yeah.
So how did you switch from primarily doing erotica to doing a pretty classic fantasy series?
I decided... When I started Exile, I hadn't even published any erotica yet. But I wrote it as a trunk novel. I had spent a year writing short stories and had sold all of them and done pretty well with that, and felt like I learned something. I had tried to launch a series that was just too big, like, for my ability at the time. I just could not manage it. At some point, the first book was published. At some point, maybe I'll go back and finish that series. And that was urban fantasy. And then, so my, like I said, my rule was that I could do whatever trope I wanted, but I had to, you know, upend it somehow. And I never meant to sell the book. I really intended to just write it as to learn, like to finish a novel and feel like I did something and completed it and learned something, and then I could sort of put it away. So that's very freeing, because I see new writers do this a lot, where they talk more about getting published than they do about their writing. And I gave myself that, you know, that time to learn without having the responsibility of publishing. But as I was writing, and as I wrapped it up, my critique group kept saying, this is the best thing you've ever written. This is, like, better than a lot of fantasy out there. You need to try and sell it. And so I did, and it still took a number of years to sell it and a lot of revision. It actually was a portal story in its first incarnation.
Really?
kind of a bad portal story. Draken didn't really change too much, but he came from our world and into this world. And, you know, portal stories are hard to kind of make. I guess to me, they're a little bit hard to make fly. So once I realized I could do the same sort of thing with Exile, and that the portal was a ship, and it wasn't, you know, he was just being exiled to another country, an enemy country. And once I realized all of, I had so many more advantages around that of things I could play with, misconceptions and things he does know and things he doesn't, you know, just flat things he doesn't, language issues. It became such a more rich story from that. So that was a good decision on my part. And it sold really pretty quickly after I did that. After I did that revision, it sold pretty quickly.
Huh. Neat. I hadn't really thought of it as, you know, kind of similar situation. But you're right, it definitely opens up, not having it as a portal story, opens you up to creating an entire, another new world. Because, you know, creating one isn't enough for a writer.
Right. Yeah.
Right. I guess it's still kind of a fish out of water story, going to a new culture and having to deal with all the strangeness. That's a pretty interesting transformation.
Yeah. And you asked earlier about how, you know, how I remind the reader of things. And, even in Exile, even though he's been there and he understands his world a lot better, there are still just a lot of new things that come up. So it's just useful to have, you know, a character that's new to his world, because obviously the reader gets to learn about that world as the character does. You see it in mysteries a lot too, where the detective has to go into what amounts to a new world and learn about that, you know, either it's a town or it's a family or whatever, and they have to learn about that. And so the reader gets to learn too as it goes.
So I'm curious now, because you do erotica, you did urban fantasy, done classic fantasy, sword and sorcery, as it were. What are you working on now? And I believe you have actually another book coming out relatively soon.
I do. Next year, early next year, it's called The Silver Scar. And it's a futuristic set here in Boulder, actually. But it's a futuristic, I want to say it's 150 years in the future. And the country is balkanized. And where the character lives is basically run by the church. So he's a soldier for the church. But when the church starts doing things that he doesn't approve of, he has to sort of decide, is he going to go along or is he going to fight it? And of course he fights it, because it would be really boring if he just went along. And so that's what that story is basically about. And it's really fantasy. My agent calls it urban fantasy, which is kind of, I'm not sure if I would call it urban fantasy. I might call it more, it has a very epic fantasy feel to it. They don't have some of the technology we do now. Some of that's fallen away. So, but they do have other technology that's different. So it's one of those books that it'll be interesting to see where it lands on the bookshelf.
That is interesting. So how do you go from writing classic sword and sorcery to, well, as you say, something that is yet to be determined in terms of classification?
You know, it's another book that I wrote a long time ago, and I wrote it pretty soon after writing Exile. And again, you know, I tried to sell it and got a few rejections, and this is when going to cons and meeting up with people and talking to your editors face to face pays off, because I'm pretty sure, you know, we just had a conversation like, you know, hey, I've got this other book. Do you want to see it? Yeah. You know, I'd love to see it. And then we, you know, and so we submitted it and they took it. It's coming out from Nightshade also, which this will be my fourth book with them. And then he asked about what I'm working on now, which again is different. It's a mystery fantasy and it's set in future Scotland.
Ooh.
So I have a draft. I'm revising. Writing mysteries is a real bitch. I have so much respect for people who write crime. There are so many. You were talking about the moving parts in The Seven Eyes, and I feel like I'm bogged. Like, I'm just overwhelmed by who said what when, and everything has to be, you know, like, timed just right. And it's a lot of plotting. So, and I did not plot nearly enough. So I'm very much learning my way through this.
That's interesting, because like I said, you do have a lot of moving pieces in this, but I suppose the repercussions of the tiny details are not quite as there as they would be with a mystery novel.
Right. Well, and I, you know, it's funny because I just met a detective, fortuitously, just through a friend, and just a great guy. And, you know, I, of course, picked his brain for like 2 hours. And my friend was here from out of town and was like, I thought you were here to see me, you know? And he when he said, you know, it's really not what they say in an interview, it's what they don't say. I went, oh, well, hell, you just like really screwed me over. I'm like, now I get to rewrite every interview scene of my entire, you know. So it's been an interesting journey. It's very fun. It's a fun story. It's called House of the Hangman, and I'm hoping to do an episodic series with it. So hopefully, you know, in the next, you know, 6 months or so, we'll get that out on the market and get it sold. And so I'm excited about it. Should be fun. There's monsters and people in kilts, and it's all kinds of fun. And I'm Scottish too, so it's been fun exploring my own Scottish background. So that's kind of fun too.
That's awesome. I think monsters and people in kilts should be the tagline.
They go together.
Yeah, they really do. Pretty much, they say, yeah.
Because I'm sold just on that description.
Just on that, I know.
Yeah.
Well, that's it's funny that you say that, because everybody I've said that to, they're like, okay,
I'm in.
Yeah. When's it going to be ready to read?
That's hilarious. Trish, do you have any more questions?
No, it's been an interesting conversation. I think we've covered what I thought of in relation to this book.
Before we wrap things up, Betsy, I mean, you told us a little bit about what you are working on now and what is coming out. Do you have anything else that you haven't mentioned so far? And where can people find you and find your work and whatnot?
I'm easy to Google under my name, Betsy Dornbush. And I am on Facebook and everywhere else that I shouldn't be when I should be writing. So, I'm easy to find online. I go to, I think, about 5 cons this year. So, mostly local, but I will be at World Fantasy. My first con is Starfest, coming up here in a couple of weeks. I don't have a lot to say about it yet, but I have some friends, we're working on a potential web show, which will be really interesting, because I don't really like being on camera, so... That should be really fun. And
your website, obviously, Google you.
Yeah, BetsyDornbush.com.
But for people who don't know, it is USCH.
Right, BUSCH, like the beer. Yes.
That did screw with me initially.
Yeah, yeah, it's German. You know, my maiden name was Hunt, and there are times when I should go back to that. I just think I should go back to that. Though I end up near cool people with D, I end up in on the bookshelves with, you know, near cool people. Yeah. So, and the books are really available anywhere. So, anywhere that sells books. So the books are easy to find too.
And you have a very active Instagram.
That's new to me, Instagram. It's been kind of fun. And, you know, I was excited because I finally got 300 followers. I was like, okay, I'm hitting the big time. My daughter is an artist, and she's 15, and she has, like, I don't know, 3,000 people or something, and she does this meme account. She's like, we have more than Hillary Clinton's Instagram or something, and I'm just going, like, you're 15, stop it.
Darn teenagers, they're just much better at social media than us old fogies, right?
I should get her help. I should hire her to do my Instagram for me, probably.
So you're going to be at Starfest, and then if I remember correctly, you're going to be at Denver Comic Con, which is a big one.
I will be at Denver Comic Con. Yeah, I'll be, that'll be interesting, because I'm going to be in Europe for a lot of June. So, and I get back just a couple days before Comic-Con. So, you know, if I seem a little bewildered, it might be jet lag and just completely different time change. And so that'll be fun. And then, I'm trying to think what else. Oh, Mile High Con. I'll be there. And then I always like to throw a word out about Rocky Mountain Fiction Writers, which is our local professional writers group. And they have a wonderful, wonderful conference called Colorado Gold in September. Always worth looking at. So I will be there too.
Awesome. Awesome. Thank you. So thank you for being on the show. We really appreciate it.
It's been very interesting.
Thank you. It's been fun.
And with that, awkward ending
and scene.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can find us at skiffyandfanty@gmail.com, on Twitter at skiffyandfanty, on Facebook at The Skiffy and Fanty Show, and on Patreon at patreon.com/skiffyandfanty. Our intro and outro music comes from The Launch by Cronux. You can find out more about their music at freemusicarchive.org.